functions of mindfulness practice is to make us increasingly aware of the amount of choice we have in any given moment. And that as we become aware of the choice, our choices in the present moment, there's the opportunity then to become freer, to have freedom with our choices. And the more mindless we are about what goes on moment by moment, the more mindless we are to our responses, the less choices we actually have. We make decisions and choices all the time, but if they're unconscious, then in a sense, there's no possibility for freedom. They happen automatically. So I wanted to follow up a little bit more on that and talk about intention tonight, the intention behind our choices. So the heart of mindfulness practice, as I think many of you know, is a deep appreciation for the present moment, deep appreciation for the possibilities inherent when we can rest and be alive mindfully in the present moment. And the present moment is really a juncture, a meeting point of many different elements, many different forces. But in that meeting of the present moment becomes a very creative moment. It's a moment of great creative potential and possibility. And part of the mindfulness is understanding the creative possibility that we all have when we dwell fully in the present moment. And as many of you know, Buddhism doesn't put any emphasis on an external savior or even an external person or a teacher that's going to do it for you, that's going to save you or solve all the problems that you have. That Buddhism really puts the mirror of back on yourself, puts a finger back on yourself. That we, each of us, needs to be our own practitioner, needs to be an island unto ourselves, a lamp unto ourselves. And each of us, through our own efforts of mindfulness and responsivity to the present moment, each of us is the... in us is we're going to find the place for our freedom, not outside of ourselves. And because of that, because we ourselves are the seat of freedom, I think it's very important to understand this creative possibility that exists when we really wake up to the present moment. And in talking about this creative possibility, I want to mention two somewhat standard aspects of mindfulness practice in our tradition. And this is the aspect of clear comprehension of the present moment. And the second is suitability of purpose. Suitability of purpose meaning being aware of the purpose or the motivation in the choices we make so they're suitable or appropriate to whatever's happening in the present moment. Clear comprehension is a lot of what mindfulness is. A lot of mindfulness is seeing clearly without the filters of our judgments or evaluations or our concepts or our preferences, seeing the present moment fully for what it is. And that, we know, is not such an easy thing because our preferences and desires and aversions and judgments are much of what gets in the way for us to really see clearly, to have clear comprehension. But clear comprehension in the classic texts is often talked about as clearly comprehending when you're walking that you're walking, clearly comprehending when you're cooking, or clearly comprehending when you're talking that you're talking, clearly comprehending that when you're breathing mindfully that you're breathing mindfully, clearly, really clear awareness, clear recognition, a kind of stable. In my mind, it's kind of this image or a sense of inhabiting whatever activity you're having, inhabiting with mindfulness, resting in the activity, not being off thinking about what's next, or not reminiscing about what was last. But clearly comprehending what's happening with you, what activity, what is happening in the present moment with you, with in your surroundings. Clear comprehension. And to be aware of the fullness of what is happening right now. As we do this, as we do the clear comprehension, one of the remarkable things we become aware of is the degree to which there's momentum into the present moment of our past actions, past things we've done. Yesterday I said something to someone that was not, it was no ill intent involved at all, but it was kind of somewhat inappropriate given the circumstances. And I didn't realize that until after I had said it, after my mouth had opened and said what I said. And for the next 6-7 hours periodically, there was this momentum of having that said this, you know, one sentence, you know, this kind of regret. Oh, I'm sorry I said that. I could feel kind of, you know, concern about how that person might have received it, and maybe the person was hurt because they misunderstood my intent. But often you can feel them, you sit down, you feel a tremendous momentum. And as we, sometimes when we get the more quieter and calm we get in meditation, the more maybe more ancient or more subtle is the momentum that we feel in our body. You sit down to meditate perhaps after the end of a very busy day, and you find the momentum of your busy day in the form of the mind just spinning around very, very fast, or you feel all this energy kind of maybe in your shoulders and your head, a lot of energetic feelings. And part of what happens in the course of maybe a sitting, maybe some of you sitting here this evening, you felt that when you came to sit, and after the end of the 45 minutes, you felt some of that momentum of energy, of agitation of the day, settle to some degree in the course of the 45 minutes. So we might feel the momentum of what happens in any given day, but as we settle and the kind of that kind of coarse agitation of the day settles away, then sometimes we're aware of maybe tensions in the shoulder or the stomach or the jaws that maybe have to do with momentum of clinging, of holding, of resistance or fear. That's not just this given day today, but is something momentum that goes back maybe perhaps many, many years or decades. And that momentum of that particular activity still resides in our body. The momentum sometimes takes the form of memories. It's fairly common for people, often when people are relatively new to meditation, to suddenly have memories of things that they've often forgotten. They haven't remembered for years and years and years, and suddenly it pops up sometimes quite vividly. And it's the popping up quite vividly is kind of suddenly the filters of repression or the filters holding it back or whatever have been released, and that momentum that's been built up inside or held inside, the pressure that's been held in there finally gets released and the memory surfaces, so there can be a finishing of unprocessed business. So we're aware of that momentum that comes on. And for some people, it's really meditation that teaches us about the nature of that kind of momentum. I think perhaps our culture all too often emphasizes immediate gratification of our desires at the expense of not understanding so much the consequences, subtle consequences, of the intention, the greed perhaps, or the lust, or the craving, or the fear that might be inherent in some of our desires as we pursue them. And so we don't necessarily pay much attention to the long-term consequences, the momentum that's set in place when we act out of fear or greed or hate in what we choose to do. But as I keep saying, you know, as we sit and meditate, that's often what catches up to us. Our life catches up to us when we give it a chance, when we kind of stop and let ourselves rest. Clear comprehension is just that. I think of it kind of like just kind of you open the blinds on your window and you just see clearly what's out in the street. You open the blinds on your inner eyes and you see clearly what's there. You see clearly your momentum, you see clearly the patterns of your mind, of your heart. You see the feelings that are there, the thoughts that are there. And there's no, a clear comprehension itself does not judge, does not evaluate, does not compare it against something else, some standard. Some idea of progress, or compare it against some other meditator or some other person we know. Clear comprehension just simply sees it for what it is. But even though it's that kind of plain or clear, like looking out a window, it's because it lacks all those negative things of guilt and shame and criticism or attachment, it's very closely akin to being really compassionate and generous and accepting of oneself. Clear comprehension is very closely akin to those things. And these are kind of what we also learn then through the act of clear comprehension, is to be compassionate and accepting of ourselves for what we find within ourselves. It's not particularly easy, as far as I can tell, to be a human being. And often we measure ourselves against some kind of standards of perfection, of how we should be doing it. And I don't think that any human being is going to do life perfect, or any of us is going to be perfect. So that often there's this tension between our idea of perfection and who we actually are. And the clear comprehension is a friend to who we actually are. It's willing to accept us and let us be who we are. It's not clear comprehension is not measuring us against any kind of standard we might want to have. So seeing ourselves clearly is a lot of what this practice is about. And as we do that, as we stop, in a sense, often what happens is we catch up to ourselves. Suitability of purpose is very closely aligned to the idea of intention. Suitability of intention, the purpose of why we do things, the motivation behind why we do things. And intention is central to the Buddhist practice. I say this pretty periodically, I emphasize this. The centrality of intention, of studying intention. If you go on a 10-day retreat, for example, somewhere near the middle of the retreat or near the end of the retreat, often the instruction will be, begin paying attention, or include in what you pay attention to in the present, and pay attention also to your intention, the motivation, the impulse that's behind the actions that you take. And some people don't quite understand what that means, and it takes a while to understand. But there are some people, sooner or later, who becomes, you see their eyes kind of open up wide, and they see the possibility of freedom and real intimacy with themselves when they start becoming aware of the motivations, either gross or subtle, before they act. Because if you're aware before you act, and you're aware of that motivation, then you may be also aware you don't have to act, or you could act differently. But if you don't see the motivation before your actions, and it's kind of automatic, those link, then there's less freedom. Now, intention is not the same things as the choices we make. The intention is what motivates those choices. It's a little bit different, and this is kind of an important distinction to make. Two people can make the same choice, can do the same action, and the motivation behind it can be very, very different. Two people can want to do some act of service out in the world, come here on Saturday and help clean the grounds. Maybe I shouldn't use such an immediate example for this. Let me choose another example. You think of your example. You fill in the blank. So some act of service. And one person, you know, they do exactly the same thing. You see the two people, they do the same thing. And one person is doing it out of feeling insecure in themselves, and out of this insecure, feeling a craving of proving themselves to the other people in the world that they're a good person. And they want to kind of get some status from it. And so by doing this wonderful service, they get some status in the community, and people look up to them, and they can be more proud and all such things, wonderful things, right? And someone else does it because makes the same choice to do the same kind of act of service, but they're not concerned about themselves at all. They're mostly concerned about the person, people they're helping. And so they actually look for, they're concerned about the welfare of someone else and feel like, well, these people need my help. I'm able to offer something, so let me see if I can be helpful. It's very different, the motivation. So the same choice to do the same kind of service, but the motivation behind the choice is very different. You understand that? This is very, very important. Now, in Buddha's teaching, there's a huge world of difference between those two motivations, even though the actions are the same. And the difference is in the consequences. And there are different, hugely different consequences from those intentions. The acts themselves have different consequences depending on that intention. The external consequences might be the same, but the internal consequences could be very different. And as I talked about before, the clear comprehension sees the momentum of our life. I think that as we appreciate the momentum of our psychic life, our psychological life, we can appreciate, perhaps begin to appreciate the difference, the different effect that motivation can have in this inner life. The person who did it out of trying to bolster his or her status might in a few years notice that, remember that, recognize that, and think back in their life, and then recognition and memory might feel kind of a little bit deflated. And that's a consequence, the momentum of this effect. or because they chose to act based on originally kind of insecurity and a kind of desire and greed, there's a kind of tensing in the body that has to happen in order to kind of act on that motivation. And so that tension might linger in their body, especially if they keep doing the same kind of activity over and over again. And then in a few years, and they stop to meditate and start noticing what's happening in their body, they notice, there's this tension. And then they might notice, this tension seems to have a lot to do with my sense of trying to prove myself in the world. The person who did this act of service out of very different reasons, motivations, but actually be generous and helpful, there was no sense of protectedness, no sense of greed or acquisitiveness in that activity. And so perhaps rather than body being tense, the body had more of an experience of being more open and being more relaxed in that activity. And so there's a momentum then set of the body being comfortable and becoming more familiar with the experience of being relaxed and open. And as the body becomes more familiar with that, there's also kind of a momentum with that also. Prisoners, you know. Ms. Mason is like a little bit. Two people can be in prison for the same amount of time, the same prison, same cell together. And the way that they choose to meet that circumstance they find themselves in, could be radically different. I talked once at the women's prison in Folsom. And I met a woman there who had been, I don't know, in prison. I don't know how long she was, but a number of years. And I was teaching a meditation class there. And she had devoted much of her time in prison to yoga and meditation. And she came with this incredible presence and joy and these bright eyes that I seldom meet, even on retreats. It was really remarkable to meet this woman. And I've heard of people who've gone through their years of prison just becoming increasingly embittered and angry. I can imagine two people kind of going through the same amount of time in prison, same cell, same situation. One person chooses and responds to that circumstances with, for example, a spiritual practice, and the other person responds and chooses to respond to the situation by holding on to the resentment and their anger. And the momentum of that has very different results when they both get released at the same time. The teaching of suitability of purpose is a teaching that we can choose how we decide to respond to circumstances of our life, to any circumstances here. And the idea being, at least in theory, as our mindfulness becomes stronger and stronger, is that even in the most extreme circumstances, we can choose whether to meet it with fear and hatred, or with compassion and understanding, or attempts to understand. And there's a world of difference between the two. And I remember the Dalai Lama once saying somewhere that it's more important to understand this notion of causality, this of karma, of intention, the role of intention in your life, than it is to understand the very deep Buddhist philosophy of emptiness, for example. That the key thing you need to understand, and other people have said this also, is this, the tremendous consequence and importance that our intentions and our motivations have in forming our inner psychological momentum, our inner psychological life. And in some sense, it shapes our personality. The repeated choices we make of how to respond forms much of our personality over a lifetime. If we choose over and over and over again to respond out of our hurt by being bitter, the bitterness sets in and sets in and sets in, and it becomes basically part of our character after a while. Sometimes this becomes extremely obvious when people become very old, and in their old age, perhaps, or maybe some people when they get senile, become very sick. Many of the normal kind of ways in which we build up ourselves or defend ourselves or create a kind of self for ourselves out of some effort and kind of begin to, we don't have the energy for it anymore. And so some of these defenses drop down, and then some of the underlying momentum of tendencies, of habit formations, begin to show themselves. And some people, a lifetime of bitterness that's been just right under the surface, kind of often hidden, That's what shines forth in these difficult, you know, times. And other people who have a lifetime of responding with good intent, that is what has become strong, and that's the momentum that reveals itself when the other kind of stuff begins to fall away. And Sylvia Borstein tells the wonderful story of her and her husband going to visit the friend of theirs. I think he was like a former president of the American Association of Psychiatrists or Psychology or something, who had been, you know, great intellect and a great mind earlier in his life. And he started to go senile, but he was still living at home, and they had been invited to his house for dinner. And they showed up at the door, and they knocked at the door, and he opened the door, and he looked at them with a complete blank look, didn't recognize them for anyone. They had been friends for years. And he looked at them and he said, "I don't have a clue who you are, but you're very welcome in my house. Please come in." So a certain momentum, you know, was there, perhaps. So the different motivations that underlies the choices we make bring different fruit. And in a very simplistic way, in the Buddhist tradition, they talk about how unskillful choices, unskillful motivations, which means motivations built on greed and hate and delusion, motivations that intend harm or bring unwholesome fruit, bring fruit of suffering. And that wholesome or skillful intentions of generosity, of love, of wisdom, bring wholesome fruits, brings happiness and joy. So it's a little bit simplistic that way, but I think I think it's kind of hard to understand the full way, all the ways, all the avenues and channels of this momentum that I'm talking about, of how our intentions, our acted intentions, carry through and bear fruit, but they do. And taking that into account somewhat as we go by through our life means that we can be motivated to be a little more careful to pay attention, not just simply to what we do and the choices we make, but what's behind it, the motivations and choices, the motivations and intentions, the volition behind it. So how do we feel? I kind of repeat again, maybe a little bit. How do we feel the consequences? How do we experience the fruits of our intentions? One is how we feel, you know, and you can actually feel almost, if you're sensitive in the present moment, you can often feel the consequence of your actions, of your intentional actions, very clearly in the present moment. Actions motivated by fear or by hate have a certain tightness and constriction that go with them, and you can feel that in the body. You feel kind of a little bit bad in doing them yourself. There was a guy named Brian Keenan, who was one of the British hostages in Beirut, who was, I think, he kept hostage for 4 years, who said that he had no desire for vengeance, to get revenge, or to hold resentment against those people who kept him hostage there in Beirut for all those years. Because vengeance, he said, is self-miming. And he didn't intend to mime himself. I think it's a very powerful thing. That when we have what's called unwholesome intentions, that one of the things we do is we harm ourselves. Even if sometimes we intentionally want to harm other people. And it can be very subtle, the way we kind of are biting at people and kind of get back at them or whatever. But in doing that very act, we're also causing suffering for ourselves. And part of the great value of mindfulness is to actually begin seeing the consequences that our actions have on ourselves. And if we take that into account, then sometimes that changes what we choose we want to do, I think. So how we feel. And then the other way, perhaps, is through our memories. Memories are significant. Even though in mindfulness we say, you know, stay in the present moment, don't get involved in memories, we should have tremendous respect for memories that arise. It happens in meditation, as I said earlier, that the kind of openness and release that happens in meditation also releases memories. And rather than fighting them or thinking they're wrong for appearing, sometimes we just need to bow to them and allow them to be part of the process. But memories, you know, of all kinds of things. I've known many, many meditators who have felt strongly called upon to go and apologize for things that they did many, many years ago, that they hadn't even thought about for many, many years. But somehow in the course of their meditation, it welled up really large. What did I do? And just kind of feeling kind of out of tune with themselves, or a little bit out of sort, until they go somehow and make amends. And they'll go make a phone call, you know, after 40 years. You know that time? What time? Well, I don't remember, but it's very nice you're apologizing. And then there's the momentum or the fruit of our conditioning, that repeated actions, repeated acting over and over again on certain intentions creates certain conditioning. We're more likely, it becomes easier to act that way again in the future. Then there's the collective momentum. You can see sometimes in certain conversations, people arguing with each other and, you know, getting angry at each other back and forth and kind of attacking the other person, and so you hurt the other person, so they get angry and upset, and they're hurt, and so they want, because of that, they're motivated to even hurt you even more, and so they kind of yell back and say, "You low, lousy," and then you feel bad, and so you feel hurt, and so then you get all riled up, and so then you throw it back even harder, and this is like, you know, the game of tennis argument, you know, and so as it builds and builds and builds until people are at blows. The collective, you know. I think all war in the world starts initially by someone's intention. The kind of intention that you can all have, the kind of motivations each of you have before you make a choice, before you act on something, it's that simple, the beginning of war and all the death and the destruction that comes with. So to begin understanding intention and appreciating it in our own life then also becomes, I believe, a great gift to society, because we begin also then offering the seeds, the foundation for peace, rather than offering the foundations for war and destruction. I don't know quite what to make of the arguments that you read about these days after Matt Shepard was killed. But, you know, the argument being that the religious right, some of the conservative Republicans who have been riling against homosexuality, has helped create a collective environment where it was easier for people to hate or express their hate towards homosexuals. So I'm not sure how to understand this kind of argument, but I think it's a very powerful argument that the people who make this statement. There's, you know, we can offer the seeds of hate, or we can offer the seeds of peace, very, very subtly by what we choose to act on. So the Tibetan teacher, kind of the founder of Tibetan Buddhism, named Padmasvambhava, said this interesting, was attributed this interesting quote. If you want to understand the past, look into the present. If you want to understand the future, look into the present. And the way I understand it is that if you want to understand the past, you'll see it in the momentum that you'll feel in the present moment. The intentions we've acted on in the past are felt in the present moment. Our future can also be understood by the present moment by looking at the intentions we choose to act on now, today, are creating our future. We are what we think, having become what we thought, is the famous beginning of all Buddhist literature, the Dhammapada. Now, in mindfulness, as I've said, we experience and open to the fruits of our past intentions in the present. And if you understand how skillful and unskillful behavior works, you understand that it's not very useful to respond to what you learn about yourself, what you notice about yourself, with more unskillful behavior. So, you know, you notice that you have all this hate, and then you said, you know, oh shit, I can't stand this part of myself, I have to get rid of it somehow. You know, that's just meeting it with more aversion. That's meeting it with another unskillful intention, which in itself creates the new unskillful fruits in the future. So if you understand that, then maybe we begin to kind of be willing to slowly loosen up our judgments and our aversion, and willing to just allow ourselves to be as we are, to allow ourselves to experience the momentum that gets carried into the present moment and just let it be, and not add more momentum to it. Let it kind of peter out finally, but not keep continuing to wind it up and fuel it. And then if we understand how our present intentions, appreciate at least somehow the way the present intentions, the energy of the impulse of acting in certain intentions, carries in various ways, in various maybe invisible channels within us, momentum into the future, then perhaps we can be a little more careful with looking at our intentions and being careful with them in the present. So intentions are like seeds. Often in Buddhism they talk about intentions as seeds. And so the question is, what kind of garden do you want to grow? But to create better karmic possibility, to create better fruit for ourselves into the future, mindfulness now is extremely important, because we want to become mindful. It's really important to become mindful enough to notice the intentions before the beginning of an action. Because sometimes we're aware of the intention that once we've started the action, but then we've already set the trajectory. We've kind of, the arrow has been released, and you can't get it back so well. It helps to notice in the middle and stop sometimes. But if you can notice before you begin your action, that's considered a lot better. Jack Kornfield, when teaching about this, talks about if you're not aware of your intention before the action starts, then you're like the person who's trying to keep his horse in the barn, but closes the door after the horse is gone. So practicing with motivations, how do we practice with paying attention to our intention? It's not so easy. It's kind of a subtlety to do that, to be aware of that. And as I said, on retreat, it's not near till the second half of a retreat that we often give the instructions to include intention. But you might start with some of the larger actions in your life, some of the larger choices you have to make. The choice you have to make, when you have to make, choose a job. You can ask yourself, spend some time, maybe some weeks, few months, reflecting deeply, what is the intention behind the job that I'm choosing? Or, maybe you're going to buy a car. What is the intention you have in the kind of car you're buying? There can be a lot of intentions operating in the kind of car you choose. Wow. I look around Palo Alto and I see a lot of intentions. and then notice, so the large things. Spend some time reflecting on it. I spent a whole year of my life reflecting on my desire to be of service, trying to study it, trying to understand it better. I was a little bit mistrustful. I was mistrustful of it, of my desire to be of service. I kind of suspected it was self-serving. I was afraid it was. I didn't want it to be self-serving. So I spent a whole year checking it out. What was the intention? Trying to find out what it was. What it was. Is it self-aggrandizing? Is it self-protection? Does it rise out of insecurity? Does it rise out of wisdom, out of an open heart, out of generosity, out of sensitivity and compassion? Another interesting place to practice intention, mindfulness of intention, is around speech. And what you might do is to choose. Don't try to be aware of all your intentions as you speak. But choose maybe each day or in 1 week or something, choose a particular area of speech. Maybe it's as simple as how you speak to the clerk at the grocery store, or maybe when you're on the phone, or maybe it's a particular person that you talk with that you have some difficulty with. So choose some particular kind of speech, a particular person, and make it like an assignment, like an exercise or homework. I'm going to try to pay attention to my intention and motivations behind what I choose to say to this person. It means maybe I don't speak as quickly, maybe there's more pause or quiet, or maybe, you know, means, I don't know what it means, but maybe, but you know, whatever it takes, choose some conversation as an exercise and see if you can learn about yourself and start appreciating all the many varied motivations. There is many motivations that goes into a speech act, one speech act. Multiple things come together. I mean, just me sitting here talking to you, I'm aware I have many motivations flow through, concerns that kind of affect, you know, what I say, from wholesome to unwholesome. I have motivations of wanting to be really helpful and say something that's useful to you and maybe helpful. I have intentions sometimes to want to impress you with my great, you know, whatever, you know, and you know, all kinds of things pass through me. And the hope is, it's okay. Whatever passes through is okay with me. My great hope and my great intention is I see them as they pass through. Because if I see them, then I don't have to act on them. And I can, act more wisely. It's okay that I have, you know, motivations to want to impress you greatly about my whatever. I don't want to be fooled by them. I don't want to be tricked into kind of believing them and getting caught by them. So speech, you know, many things goes on in speech. But all this is not leading up to endless effort of monitoring ourselves all the time with a lot of effort. As mindfulness becomes stronger, it becomes more effortless. As mindfulness becomes stronger, it's really more like you're opening the curtains on this window and you just see what's there. It's not like you're constantly having to peer out that window with, you know, great intensity. You can relax and just look out the window and you see clearly what's there. And as we understand intention better and see our own intentions and motivations better, the greater ease develops around our intentions, because we kind of let certain ones go and we can choose and act on other ones. And it's not so much an effort to monitor ourselves all the time as it becomes more kind of just an easeful kind of swimming in this ocean of varied intentions that arise. But eventually, as we become more free, Buddhist practice leads to a very interesting place. And that is, initially we understand that wholesome, skillful actions lead to happiness. And unwholesome, unskillful actions lead to suffering. And then the tendency of some people is to, well, let's choose only to do wholesome activity. Let's only do good, so we can only be happy. There's actually a third option, which the Buddha taught, and this is what's really unique about what the Buddha had to offer. That, you know, you reap as you sow is kind of an ancient tradition. Buddhism doesn't have a monopoly of this kind of teaching. But I think what the Buddha kind of offered that's different was he offered a third possibility, and that's the possibility of freedom. And that's the possibility of doing an act in which, this is a little bit hard to understand, I don't know if I can really convey it very well, but where there's no intention behind the act. There's no spin to the act. And because there's no spin to the act, there's no traces, no momentum that's created. The act is done cleanly without any momentum. And rather than leading to happiness, it leads to freedom or to clarity or to great experience of lightness or openness, something different than happiness that is actually much better than happiness, or a greater happiness than happiness, or whatever. It's kind of like three people can go dancing. Do the same dance floor, same music, same level of ability. One person dances to show off. Look how good I am. Another person dances with her partner and really wants to help the partner. He's really concerned about the partner learning and partner not making a fool of himself or herself or whatever. And, you know, so it's really there to dancing to be helpful. And the third person just dances. There's no intention. There's the music moves, and the person just moves. And there's no desire, no aversion, no resistance. It just the activity happens. Something like that is the action that happens when a person is free. That action happens. The person looks like they're being of great service, but there's no intention of being of service in a kind of way. There's no momentum. There's no traces. There's no spin being placed on it. It's just free. It's like being completely open-handed, and it's gone. Make sense? So, may all of you have a good time dancing. We're a little bit, a couple of minutes over, but if we can maybe take two questions, if they can have short answers. Yes, Jean.
What do you think is the root of the, I'm feeling a little judgment about the good intentions and the not so good intentions, which I share. But what do you think is the root of those different paths?
So the root, you mean, the root meaning, what do you mean by the root?
Why some people have
Ah. Well, the word root is a very Buddhist word, and the Buddha talked about six roots, the three wholesome and three unwholesome. And the unwholesome are greed, hate, and delusion. The unwholesome and the wholesome are generosity, love, and understanding, or wisdom. And so those are the roots. But I think that dissatisfaction in all its various forms and fear in all its various forms is often one of the kind of primary roots for being motivated to do unwholesome action, often.
Dissatisfaction
would mean aversion? I think aversion is kind of a response to dissatisfaction. Dissatisfaction is kind of feeling of malcontent, of suffering, of pain. So A lot of the unwholesome behavior often arises out of attempts to try to deal with our suffering or our discomfort. And wholesome activity can come from feeling content and sensitive to the world around us and being content, or it can come from having a wise relationship to our discomfort. Yes?
Regarding what's the role of the teacher in helping you examine your intentions? It seems to me like it would be very easy to be self-deluded for a year or 10 years and examining.
That's all? Yeah, sometimes, it doesn't have to be a teacher. It can be friends or, people you respect or strangers you meet in the airplane you kind of open your heart to or something. Sharing your life and with other people and having other people saying this is what I'm doing and this is why I'm doing it, and having other people sometimes ask questions, and sometimes other people sometimes can kind of see things that we don't see for ourselves, and so having someone else asking questions or making little pointers, have you looked here, can be very useful. And so sometimes a teacher has that role if the student asks the teacher to do that, but it doesn't have to be a teacher.
Something that goes outside of yourself.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's very useful to get to include other people, and in that sense, not to be so self-contained. It's pretty hard to practice in a very deep way, and really let the practice go really thoroughly and deeply into our lives. And one of the ways to kind of help it go deeply into our lives is to share our practice and what goes on with our practice with other people, to find other people here or other practitioners to talk with and have tea with, or just hang out with and spend talking about practice. Or there are some discussion groups that get formed, and join one of the discussion groups and talking with teachers on retreats or outside retreats in many ways. So let's go dance. Thank you.